So this evening we're going to continue with our look at the Fourth Noble Truth. As I mentioned last week, the first section is sort of thought of as the wisdom section. You know, wise view and wholesome intention, heading off in the right direction. Then we come to the, what's called, I think of as the virtue section. Right? Wholesome speech, wise action, and conscious livelihood. I think it's interesting, you know, here we have, we formed, you know, we reached some sort of clear view of the importance of actually doing something. We've set the wholesome intention to actually go off and do something. And the Buddha doesn't then talk about, you know, how to meditate. He talks about how to live your life in the world. I think this sort of makes it clear how important this section is. These are all, everything I'm going to talk about today are all things we can practice. Just like we can practice sitting meditation and concentration and mindfulness and all those things. All of these things are all practices as well. One of the retreats I was on, one of the teachers said something that always has struck me. You know, like on retreat, you have these sort of times when you're sitting, times when you're doing walking practice, and then times when you're doing stuff, you know. Taking a shower, eating a meal, going for a walk, you know, having a nap, whatever. And he said, we get it backwards. We think that sitting is most important, then walking practice, and then other stuff. And he said, flip it around. Let the other stuff be the most important part of your retreat. Then walking practice, and then sitting practice. Because if what we're doing doesn't apply to how we live in the world, why are we bothering? Because we're not going to be on retreat all the time. We're going to be on retreat for small amounts of time, maybe, you know, slightly longer periods of time. But the bulk of our lives are spent living in the world. And so it's really important that we understand that this is important. This isn't like, well, some sort of wagging finger lecture. This is like, these are all things we have to practice. And the reason it's so important is it allows us to sort of get our mind to be stiller, because we're speaking and acting in the world in wholesome ways. So the first of these three, as I mentioned, was wholesome speech. In another teaching, the Buddha gave called the 10 forms of unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. So the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind, 4 of the 10 were about speech. So he puts quite a bit of emphasis on speech here and in other teachings as well. That's because when we speak, if we're not careful, if we're not mindful as we're speaking, if we're not wholesome as we speak, we get ourselves into a lot of trouble, basically. And we cause suffering both for ourselves and others if we're not careful how we speak. And so there are these 4 traditional categories of things that we have to pay attention to. We don't want to tell lies. We want to tell the truth, right? We want to be honest. But that doesn't mean we feel that truth-telling is all important, you know, because sometimes people aren't ready to hear the truth. In fact, you know, they might be not well, and you're going to give them, you're going to go someone who's sick, and you go, you got this because you went to that thing, and there were all those other people who were sick, and you stayed anyway. People aren't ready to hear that when they're sick, right? So being truthful doesn't mean you can just blather anything that's true anytime you want. It has to be at the right time. Harsh speech. This is, you know, where we bark, where we, you know, feel that it's appropriate to, you know, set someone straight, right? I'm going to set them straight. And we sort of speak in a way that people aren't going to be receptive to, but we sort of, it's sort of this righteous indignation energy going on often. And all it does is put people off, and they're not going to hear you because you're just upsetting them. So you're getting wound up. Harsh speech, you're always getting wound up yourself. And you're just going to wind up the people who are you're speaking to because they're not hearing you clearly because of the vibe of what you're saying. And there's gossip. It's a whole separate category that Buddha puts under gossip. Gossip is an interesting one. When you think about it, whenever you gossip, there's always this element of harm to someone else. And self-aggrandizement, saying, I know something that you should know. Maybe you don't know this yet, but don't let anybody else know I told you. That sort of energy is always involved in gossip. It's partly making yourself feel important, partly showing someone else how important you are, and usually harming someone else. Saying something about someone who, if they, you won't say it if they're there. Because, you don't want, it's like that's not. So gossip is always harmful. And then in the list that the Buddha gives, the last one I think is great. It's called useless speech, which is just all the mindless blather, that goes on in the world, partly in our own lives. I mean, and I'm not saying that sometimes, like you're in a situation, some sort of social situation, because we're social beings, we're householders, right? There's times when you have to sort of politely chit chat because that's sort of part of the social thing that's going on. But a lot of times, someone is talking and we want to get our acts in, right? We want to get our idea in right away, to look wise, perhaps, or to show them I know something too, or whatever. And a lot of times when we do that, when the impulse to speak arises in those sort of situations, pretty much useless. It's just like blather. Like I'm just, aren't I brilliant? Or look at me, look at me, look at me. I know something too. And it's so hard not to want to do that because we want to be part of the scene, part of the social situation. Had a friend who suggested you spend one day a week really paying attention to your speech. Like before you say anything in any situation, pause. Hit the pause button and go, is this wholesome? Is this appropriate? Am I harming anyone? Is this harsh? Am I being too forceful? Is this useful at all? It's like if you stop and actually think, probably half of what you say you wouldn't say anymore. Which would be, it'd be interesting just to do that. I mean, that's why silence is emphasized so strongly in the Buddhist traditions, because silence allows us to sort of step back and go, oh, yeah, I don't really need to say that. And we see the impulse to arise. We see the intention to speak arise. And if we see the intention, we can always then decide, do I really need to say this? It's a really interesting practice if you want to play with speech in this way. I've made speech sounds like really sort of, this is a negative view, right? In a sense, here's something else from the Buddha. And this is the Buddha speaking about speech from a sort of a positive point of view, from a wholesome point of view, in a sense. Bhikkhus, let's also remember, possessing five factors, speech is well spoken, not badly spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. What five? It is spoken at the proper time. What is said is true. It is spoken gently. What is said is beneficial. In other words, not useless, right? And it is spoken with a mind of loving kindness. Can we actually imagine what it would be like if everything we said, all five of those had to be true? You know, it's true, it's spoken gently, what is said is beneficial. It's spoken with a mind of loving kindness. And it's spoken at the proper time. As I was mentioning it a bit earlier, sometimes it's not the right time to say something. It might be true, it might be all those other things. You might say it very gently, but if it's not the proper time, why are you saying it? Because you feel like it shouldn't be said. You know, there's that sort of self-righteous vibe to that sometimes. Anyhow, there is another whole way to look at speech. I mean, diving into this book, and I wanted to share this a little bit. This is book called Advice Not Given, A Guide to Getting Over Yourself by Mark Epstein. And it's he has something interesting to say about speech I wanted to share. He's saying, while right speech conventionally means abstaining from lying, gossip, vain talk, and hurtful rejoinders, all of which create turmoil in the mind, it has taken on an additional meaning for me. I should mention he's a Freudian psychotherapist, so it has a sort of therapeutic view to it in a sense. How we talk to ourselves is as important as how we speak to each other. The way we think is as crucial as what we say aloud. Both Buddhism and psychotherapy ask to pay careful attention to the stories we repeat under our breaths. We tend to take them for granted, but they do not always accurately reflect the truth. Right speech is traditionally presented as the first of the three ethical qualities to be cultivated in the Eightfold Path. Outer speech is emphasized because there is a choice involved in what we say and how we say it. It is rare, even when we are trying to free associate, that we actually speak without thinking, without some kind of intentionality behind what we say, other than like a scream when you're whacked by a stick or something. You know, other than that, everything you say, there's always has to be intention. The mental formation of intention has to arise, and if we can see that intention arise, then we can have choices, right? The classic approach to right speech asks us to pay attention to the space between the thought and the action, and to intervene when words we want to say have a toxic quality. But then he goes on, he says, while the classical portrait focuses on refraining from harsh outer speech, in my view, right speech can also be applied to our inner worlds. We can catch and question our loops of thought and rein them in, interrupting what appears to be an involuntary inner cascade. Many people are resigned to the way they speak to themselves. They do not like it, yet they accept it as a given. This is just who I am, they say when pressed. But resignation is not the form of acceptance the Buddha recommends. Right speech asks us to take seriously the stories we tell ourselves, but not to take them for granted. Seeing them clearly gives us back some power over them. Just because you think it, I often say to my patients, doesn't make it true. I love that. Just because you think it doesn't make it true. If we could take that in and realize that, how much, you know, because there's so much of what we say to ourselves, which is, you know, can be either self-critical or critical of someone else. Just because you think it doesn't mean it's true. That's, I think it's a really important statements that he makes here. So that's wise speech or wholesome speech. Then there's wise action. Traditionally, so this is how we actually act, as opposed to speech, act, like actually do something. And once again, all of our physical acts, whatever they are, all are preceded by intention. Intention has to be there before we do anything physical with our body. And so, if we can once again see the intention arising, then we can choose to act or not act. Is this wise? Is this wholesome? Is this skillful? We can ask ourselves and then make wise choices. Traditionally, this is expressed as what's called the five precepts. These are precepts that are taught to beginning monks. The very first thing the monks hear are these five precepts, the first five. But it's also taught, every retreat I've ever been on, and every retreat I've ever taught, for that matter, we always talk about the precepts. They're like, here's ways you can think about, here's things you can practice to have your action become wiser and more wholesome. First one is non-harming. So non-harming is like, I don't go around whacking people. We think I'm not harming, right? But again, if you start thinking, in a larger perspective, it's like, is the way I consume or overconsume causing harm in the world? I mean, how wide a view of harming do you want to take? I guess is what I'm pointing to. And this requires us actually thinking about it. Oh, wait, is how I, shop or how I drive my car or how, whatever, is that causing harm in the world in some way? I mean, there's obvious ones. So like if you own a factory and you dump pollutants into a river, well, of course you're harming other people. That's an obvious one. But we can all look at everything we do and from that particular point of view. Is this causing harm in the world or harm to other people? Taking only what is offered. Now, on retreat, this means, you're on retreat, there's food given, that's what you eat. You got a room, that's what you got. There's no like, oh, I need something special, I need this, I need that. But I think, once again, in the world of householders as opposed to the world of monastics, this has a deeper meaning or broader meaning perhaps. And that's once again looking at all the stuff we have. We're householders, we need to have stuff. We need to have a car to get to places, and we need, things that, clothes and all that sort of stuff. We need things, right? But do we overconsume? Do we have too much stuff? Do I really need yet another nice shirt? Or do I really need, in my case, I'm a carpenter, I've done a lot of carpentry work. When I walk through the tool section of MacGuckin's, I have to sort of put blinders on and not look, because I'm like, oh, look at that cool tool. I don't have one quite like that. It's like, it's so tempting, right? To consume, to get yet another cool tool. But I don't need it. If I don't need it, I don't need to get it. And also look at stuff and go, oh, look, I haven't used this thing in 2 years. Time to give it away. Like, there's lots of people who might want to actually have good use for that thing, whatever it is. Whether it's clothes you don't wear anymore, or in my case, tools I don't use anymore. Or there's long lists of things, and we just look at stuff and go, oh, I don't need this anymore. Out it goes. Just let it go, because then it goes out into the world, and someone else finds a good use for it, and it circulates out in the world. Correct speech. Well, we've already spoken about that a lot. On the retreat, of course, this means noble silence. But in the context of the precepts, it's more like, the wholesome speech I just spoke about. So I won't say anything more about that at the moment. But the fourth one, refraining from sexual misconduct. This is like, oh, he's going to talk about that. But the interesting thing is, if you put this in the context of the other precepts, it's quite clear what the Buddha is getting at here. If you're expressing sexual energy, is it causing any harm? Are you taking only what is offered? Are you going to gossip about it later? Or boast about it later? Or feel like, oh, I got to be really careful because if someone finds out about this, they're going to know about it and talk about it. If any of those vibes arise, you go, wait a second. Maybe this isn't such a good idea. And that's when the Buddha talks about sexual misconduct. That's what he's talking about. How does it affect our mind and how does it affect those people around us? There's nothing in any of the Buddha's teachings I've ever come across that says anything about, well, only between a man and a woman. Or only between two people, for that matter. I mean, it just has none of that. There's no wagging morality fingers in the Buddha's teachings. It's just, how does this affect those others around you? And it's really interesting to put this in the context of the fifth precept, which is not abusing alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. I love that whole sentence. I think it's great. Leads to heedlessness, right? How many times have we been high or drunk and done something unwholesome? So it's like, oh, wait, I'm high, or they're high, or we're both high. Maybe we need to cool it, which is the exact opposite of what goes on in our culture most of the time, right? It's like you want to get a little high so you can sort of lose your inhibitions a little bit and go do things maybe you normally wouldn't do. So that's, once again, refraining from sexual misconduct means not taking advantage of or doing something that lowers your resistance to being wholesome and wise. It's an interesting way to look at it, right? But it's all of these things, all this list of five precepts, all interact with each other quite distinctly. But Joseph has a really interesting thing to say about this. I want to share this with you. He's saying, so much of what the Buddha taught seems so obvious. Don't kill, don't steal, don't harm. Still, as we try to apply and practice this in our lives, we can come to the forward edge of our understanding and commitment. This edge can be a challenging place to be. One teacher commented that if practicing the precepts, notice he said practicing, these precepts are all practices, practicing the precepts doesn't make us uncomfortable, it's probably a sign we should investigate them more deeply. It doesn't make us uncomfortable. It's like, it's so easy to fall into the, oh, I'm okay, I'm afraid, I don't do stuff like that, I'm not like that. And we just to fall into that way of thinking and believing. Joseph goes on, I appreciate this comment because it points to these steps on the path as actual practices, things to understand and investigate in our lives, rather than taking it for granted that we're basically good people and then looking no further. These are all practices, things we have to examine everything we do and everything we say and go, is this wholesome? Is this useful? Is this wise? It's a big ask. Because so much of what we do is on sort of automatic pilot. We don't stop to think about a lot of things we do, we've done because we've done them. Well, I've done it that way for 75 years. Why should I change now? I mean, then I can go there very easily, right? But it's like you have to look and go, oh, does that really make sense, you know, within the context of the Buddhist teachings? Oh yeah, huh. Practices. We call these things practices, right? That means we're not always going to succeed. Sometimes we're going to like be practicing and just mess up royally. That's called being human. And we have to be really careful not to think we're supposed to be perfect. That's not what the Buddha is pointing to. He's not pointing to being perfect. He's pointing to, here's things, here's practices you can put into your daily life that leads towards being a little more perfect. It's a continuum, it's a practice. So it isn't like an end point. You don't ever stop practicing these things. Yeah, because now I'm perfect. I don't have to do anything right. Because when we aren't perfect, then that's when we beat ourselves up. Oh, I messed up again. What's wrong with me, right? There's another interesting thing. And I think this is once again from advice not given by Mark Epstein. There's a Buddhist story of two monks crossing a river. Two men come upon a young woman who is having trouble getting to the opposite shore. One of the monks, despite his vows to never touch a woman, which is one of the vows that monks would take, picks her up and deposits her on the other side of the water. As they continue on the way, the other monk, the one who has kept his vows and not touched her, cannot stop chastising his overly benevolent friend. How could you do that? He asks. You know touching a woman is against our vows. And you were holding her. The other monk replies, I put her down long ago. You're still carrying her. I've always loved this story. The monk who picked up the woman while breaking his vows did what was required in the moment. He responded sympathetically to the person in need and exhibited right action. The other monk, holier than thou, while adhering to the letter of the law, was the more attached of the two. Playing by the rules, he was looking for safety rather than paying attention to what the situation called for. His unconscious severity was structuring his response, and we can infer masking his envy of his friend's serendipitous contact. Even after his friend had put her down, the second monk was still obsessing over her. While endeavoring to be a good Buddhist, he was inadvertently revealing just how difficult it was for him to let go. Buddhist tales make this point over and over again. Our lives are made dull by our efforts to over-control things. The joy of creative expression arises out of surprise. If we live our lives like the overly severe monk, thinking only about the rules, we walk through life with blinders on. If we can open, like the first monk, we find that life's unpredictability is full of interesting and invigorating challenges. These challenges engage us in unexpected and unanticipated ways and allow for freedom of unscripted responsiveness. Right action is more than just reaction. Great line. Right action is more than just reaction. It springs from an attunement to the moment that the confines of convention obscure. So he's pointing to we can become, if we're like, I'm going to always follow the precepts. I'm going to be the perfect follower of the precepts. You become holier than thou very quickly if you're not careful. And you also miss opportunities to actually act in useful and hopeful in ways that are actually wholesome, useful, can help others in the world. Even if at the time it seems like, oh well, but I don't know if that's, so those that's why these are practices too, right? Because we have to, like, we can't just follow rigid rules. We have to be able to apply these precepts to the moment, and that's the situation, and go, oh, yeah, in this particular case, this makes more sense. One of my teachers used to have this, his favorite example of this. It's like you're sitting in the room with a bunch of other people. One of them is named Fred, right? And some guy walks in with a gun and says, "Is Fred here?" And you say, "Fred? Who's Fred?" I mean, you lie outright because the situation calls for it. You don't want to say, "Yeah, that's Fred. That's over there." It's like, obviously, you're gonna not tell the truth in that situation. It's more wholesome to lie your face off because of the situation. And that's a wild example, but you see where I'm going. Everything is, we have to look at the context, the greater picture. Which makes it harder to do this. If it's just blind rule following is a lot easier than actually being able to take things and see them and go, first of all, be aware and know that you're practicing and see the intention to do something, and then deciding in that moment whether this is wise or and skillful or not. Within the context of the precepts, but not being bound by them. It's a different way to think. So that's the second of these fine things. And then conscious livelihood. It's a really interesting thing. Since we're all householders, we all have livelihood, right? In one way or another, we pay our bills. So we can't divorce how we make a living from our practice. It's like, well, that, no. I have my life and then I have my practice. We can't separate those two. They have to be woven together. Think of how much time we spend in our adult lives actually doing something to bring in income to pay the bills. It's huge. It's enormous. Or what we do with our money and how we use our money. Here, this is one place where the Buddha was very specific about ways of making a living that were harmful. And all of these, if you look at them for more than 5 seconds, you can see they fall directly out of the five precepts. So this is the list that you often see. Trading in weapons and instruments for killing. Making a living out of giving people things to kill things with. Slavery. I mean, well, slavery, that's old story, right? Slavery ended in the United States back in 1867 or whatever it was. I don't know my American history that well. Actually, slavery is going on right here in Boulder County today. I guarantee you that's true. I have a student who, for a while, who was on the vice squad. And mainly their whole emphasis, more than anything else, was breaking up trafficking of women into situations that were essentially slavery. And it was going on right here in Boulder County all the time. It's like this is something that happens in right there in our world. We just don't see it because we live in a separate planet almost. But it's something that has never gone away. Never gone away. And Keith, and even in the Buddhist times, this was like perfectly normal. People, everybody had slaves. Anybody who was rich had slaves. And he said, no, can't do that anymore. Very radical for his time. The production of meat and killing of animals. Manufacturing or selling alcohol and drugs. Making or selling poisons. Any profession that involves deceit, the catch-all one. And so, I mean, these all seem like, well, of course, this is all obvious. But think of, we're talking about major industries here, right? Meat packing, making and selling alcohol and weapons, making poisons, like, well, there's lots of things people make that are poisonous that we don't label them poisons, but we keep hearing about things that are poisonous that are in things they spray on our lawn or put in our food, or it's like endless. And any profession that involves deceit, well, it covers a pretty wide range of things as well. The Buddha also said that the most conducive professions are teaching and farming. Interesting. Yeah, but this is like, remember, he said this back 2,600 years ago in a very rural agrarian culture where pretty much everybody farmed. Like the vast majority of people had land and grew crops and had took care of cows and things like that. That was like the normal thing that most people did. And since then, these were like wholesome things to do. Farming, you're feeding yourself and feeding other people. And teaching, you're feeding people's minds. Well, we live in a world where we probably can't all be farmers and teachers. There's a lot more, our world has become much, much more complex than the Buddha's world 2,600 years ago. So think of this. See if you can approach whatever work you do with an attitude of service. This is what I'm doing useful in the world, in the broader sense. It's an interesting question to ask yourselves. And then that doesn't mean you have to have a job like in, say, healthcare or social work, which are helping, quote, the helping professions, right? But it means that every time we look at what we're going to choose to do to make a living, is it actually useful in the world, or is this just this really cool way to make money that I need? And I'm not saying we don't need to make money, because we all have to make money to live in the world, right? But can we adjust what we do in a way that's wiser than sometimes get caught doing. Of course, Mark Epstein has something to say about this too. Encouraging reflection on one's vocation, right livelihood brings up a number of provocative questions. What place does work have in my life? What is driving me? Do I have ethical qualms about my job? Does my livelihood define me? Is my salary the most accurate reflection of my worth? The Buddha said that most people are motivated by what he called the eight worldly concerns: gain and loss, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, and fame and disgrace are the ones he specified. He was careful not to judge people for these preoccupations, although he cautioned that they all come and go. Despite their relative impermanence, many of them are referred to with the utmost respect in the Buddhist ancient discourses. At one point, the Buddha remarks that there are four kinds of happiness a householder should seek: ownership, wealth, debtlessness, and blamelessness. So the Buddha never said at any time that it was wrong to make money. As a monk, unless you were a monastic, then monastics weren't allowed to even touch money, let alone earn money. I want to go on with Mark here for a second. Right Leviat also asks us to pay attention to the eight worldly concerns and trying to find a place of balance within them. Do we chase praise, profit, pleasure, and fame as if they were the most important things in the world? As if once we corral them, they will last forever? Do we make our failures the linchpin of our low self-esteem? Do we judge ourselves on whether we can avoid pain and loss? If we allow our identities to rest only on such things, we are destined for disappointment. There is always someone wealthier, more famous, more recognized, or more accomplished than we are. Always someone with more likes on social media. The effort to maintain one's status, wealth, youth, position, beauty, recognition, or prestige can be an endless source of suffering. And the self-criticism that surfaces under the spell of inevitable loss, pain, blame, and disgrace can bedevil us for a lifetime. We think we've got it all figured out, we've got it all made, and then stuff happens, which is always us. You know, and then we go, oh, well, I must have done something wrong. Right? No, you're living life in the world the way it makes sense. He goes on a little bit more. Right livelihood asks us to pay attention to the quality of our interactions, not just in how successful the world tells us we are. Right livelihood is not only about what we do, but also about how we do it, writes Joseph Goldstein. Because it is about our behavior in the world, it can also be thought of as right living or right relationship. Many people overlook this aspect of things. They are making a living as their essential task and are bothered when the competing demands of daily life intrude. They consider anything that detracts from their primary mission as a nuisance, as beneath them, outside the realm of the meaningful, and a drag. Right livelihood suggests that money is not the only currency worth paying attention to. It suggests that many of us are locked into a formulaic way of thinking about work that gives too little consideration to how we actually behave. The ethical dimension of right livelihood does not have to be limited to a prohibition in trading weapons, drugs, or human beings. Right livelihood encourages us to be ethically aware of how we interact and how we relate, not just to our level of achievement. I mean, what he's saying is so against our entire culture. You might notice that, but he's going against the stream of our culture here, quite intentionally. I did want to read this little thing from Opola Rahula. This is a book called What the Buddha Taught. And it's just, once the Buddha told Anathapindika, the great banker, one of his most devoted lay disciples, who founded for him the celebrated Jetavana Monastery, that a layman who leads an ordinary family life has four kinds of happiness. First happiness is to enjoy economic security or sufficient wealth acquired by just and righteous means. So it's okay to make money, he's saying. It's okay to have an income. The second is spending that wealth liberally on himself, his family, his friends, and relatives, and on meritorious deeds. In other words, helping others who are less fortunate, using some of your wealth to do that. I've been thinking a lot about food banks in the last week or so, and how desperate food banks are for income right now, to help people get enough food because they're not getting the SNAP benefits. Good place to put some of that extra money we have, perhaps. The third is to be free from debts, which is so contrary to what our culture says. Our whole culture is all about, go here, get another credit card, because the other ones were maxed out, and seemed, so you can get a little more debt and get all that stuff you really want, even though you don't have the money for it. The opposite of what Buddha's saying here. And the fourth happiness is to live a faultless and pure life without committing evil in thought, word, or deed. That is, living, being virtuous, like we've been talking about all evening. And those are the four happinesses. I like the way that's phrased. Here's things that make us happy living in the world. To have enough income that we can, or we're okay, and we make it in a virtuous way. Spending it and enjoying it, but also making sure we take care of others. Doing our best to stay out of debt, or being out of debt. And then leading a virtuous life. You know, the bliss of blamelessness, the Buddha used to call it. So there's a lot to pay attention to here. I mean, this is like a long list. And to be on the path, I mean, you know, you had right view, wholesome view, you had wholesome intention, and now you decide to go out onto the path. These are all things we need to practice, because all of them lead to our mind being calmer and stiller, so that when we do go to sit, when we do go to formally practice, right, in that way, our mind's more likely to go still. It's as simple as that, really. I mean, if we go around, we're whacking people and stealing, our minds are not going to be calm when we go, when we sit down. I'm not saying any of you go around whacking people and stealing, but you know what I'm saying. There's lots of more subtle things here that we have to pay attention to. And we have to take everything we do and look at, go, how does this fit? Where does this fit on this spectrum of being virtuous? Wise action and wholesome speech. It's a, like I said earlier, it's a big ask to actually do that consciously, choose to do that. This is from Mary Oliver, from her book A Thousand Mornings. It's just a little piece of this longer poem, which expresses what I'm trying to say quite clearly. I know I can walk through the world, along the shore or under the trees, with my mind filled with things of little importance, in full self-attendance, a condition I can't really call being alive. To live a life in full self-attendance, it's all about me. But she says it so beautifully. Yeah, because it's not like I'm walking along the world, along the shore, under the trees. My mind filled with things of little importance, in full self-attendance, a condition I can't really call being alive. I like the thought.